Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman.
There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril. Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't just discovered that your life was an elaborate virtual simulation designed to keep you docile whilst the energy from your body is being harvested by nefarious machines. My name is Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea lair for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and of course, a nice cup of tea. I do hope you don't mind being asked to wear the capes and velvet cloaks Latimer gave you. They were just to ensure we could all be smuggled into the ball at this rather grand country estate. The chap who opened the door for us and ushered us inside was no less than Latimer's great-great-grandfather, would you believe? He has kindly allowed us to use one of the many reception rooms not in use this evening, so we can take tea in peace, without fear of giving away the fact none of us actually hail from 1892, and most certainly do not have invitations. As Latimer still hasn't produced a reliable means of visiting different times without being noticed, I decided that we should find an alternative means of enjoying the trip instead of just watching through a window. Don't forget, my lovelies, if you feel a tingling in your toes, that's perfectly normal, having travelled through space and time to be here using Latimer's marvellous time bubble. Do speak up if you experience intense déjà vu, but I assure you, any risks are far outweighed by the soft glow of the gaslight and the sounds of the orchestra floating through the door. There's a spot where we can actually watch the ball through a spy hole, something I recommend you do before we leave. Oh, and do be dears, and try not to stand or sit on the chickens. They do tend to get underfoot.
I'm sorry to disturb you, ma'am, but your guest has arrived, a Lieutenant Michael Cole.
Oh, marvellous. Let's see his calling card. Michael H. Cole, Lieutenant of Coast Guards. Lives saved, federal maritime law rigorously enforced, national custom assured, also writing. How splendid! Is he wearing his uniform?
Yes, ma'am.
Is he wearing it rigorously?
Most rigorously, ma'am.
Even better. Show him in, Latimer. For those of you who don't know, Mike Cole is the author of the Shadow Ops series published by Ace Books. The first of the series, Control Point, won the Compton Crook Award. His rather impressive military career has included counter-terrorism, cyber warfare, and 3 tours in Iraq. His shouting is also rather impressive.
Lieutenant Cole, ma'am.
Hello, Mike. It's lovely to see you. Please do come and sit down. So, how are you?
I am well, ma'am. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Would you like some tea?
You'll forgive me, ma'am, but I take neither tea nor coffee. It dulls the senses, and it's important that I be prepared for any eventuality.
Oh, my goodness. What would you prefer to drink?
Water is fine, ma'am. It has served me well for 40 years.
Would you like a slice of lemon with it?
No, ma'am. That strikes me as an extravagance. It's important to keep things plain.
Just water, then. Oh, I don't know if this would be a little too extravagant, but I was wondering if you'd like to try some Banbury cake.
That's a sweet cake, isn't it, ma'am?
It is. It's kind of an oval shape. It's got puff pastry on the outside, and it's filled with currants and kind of sugar and fruit and rum, which is why we chose it.
Ma'am, that's quite delightful, and I hope you won't take offense when I refuse.
Ah, a shame. Well, perhaps we could wrap some for you for you to take away when you're off duty later on.
I'd be glad to make it available to the mess, but it's certainly not something I would partake in.
Ah, I see. Yes, yes, I understand that you take your job very seriously.
And my men as well. A good officer always puts his people before himself.
Oh, well, I couldn't agree more. Now, when I extended my invitation to you, I invited you to bring a curio with you. I was wondering what you've brought with you today.
Well, if you'll see here in this small glass box that I'm placing on the table, a small iridescent blue fish. This is a fish that was a gift to me from my niece on Christmas. Now, as you can imagine, I travel a great deal and work a lot, and often in very trying circumstances, and one would not think that a fish would make a suitable traveling companion to a man in my position. However, it is a gift from my niece, and she does check in on it frequently, so here I am carrying about a fish.
Well, it's a very handsome fish.
He is. You know, I will confess to be at a bit of a loss. I would imagine men in other lines of work might be more familiar with how to care for it, keep it entertained. I have taken to reading to it in the evenings, but it doesn't seem terribly interested.
Ah, well, perhaps getting it one of those little diving men that you put inside the tank, perhaps something like that, something for it to talk to.
I'm told that if one puts a looking glass on the side of the tank, it will attack it with some degree of regularity for matters of exercise. I am seeking to acquire one and look forward to hopefully making the fish's life a little more physical.
Does he have a name?
My niece has named him Winter Soldier, which, if you recall, is the... I don't know if you're familiar with comic books, ma'am, but Captain America's sidekick, Bucky, after being frozen in ice along with the captain, after being falling off a buzz bomber, this is during World War II, in pursuit of the Nazi Lord Baron Zemo, was later recovered by the Soviets and turned into... a superhero with a cybernetic arm called the Winter Soldier, and my niece has named the fish for this man.
Ah, but I notice it doesn't have a cybernetic fin or anything. It's quite a curious name for such a plump and rather pretty fish, but I like that.
Ma'am, I am ruled by my niece in all things, so if she desires to name it the Winter Soldier, then the Winter Soldier it shall be.
Now, you're a member of the U.S. Coast Guard, and the Coast Guard in America is a part of the military, which I think is far more sensible than how we do things in the U.K.
Yes, sir, we are, ma'am. We are the only part of the United States military who is also a police force. However, I did have the pleasure of visiting Your Majesty's Coast Guard at Barricade on Thames in London and seeing your search and rescue operations there. And have the pleasure of the acquaintance of several members of your Royal National Lifeboat Institution.
Wonderful, wonderful institution.
Yes, they are. I have a standing offer to members of the Coast Guard and the RNLI in your country to give away my books. As a matter of fact, I just put one in the post to one of the Majesty's Coast Guard's Cliff Rescue Unit members in Wales.
Oh, that's splendid. I grew up in Cornwall, right on the coast, so the RNLI was something that was hugely important. We did a lot of fundraising for them when I was at school, and my father was based at RNAS Coldrose for a long time, and they have a big search and rescue branch there.
It's incredibly impressive to us in the Coast Guard. As you know, we're a branch of the military, so we're funded by taxes. But to see what a expansive and capable rescue service you run as a charity, entirely dependent on public funds given as, you know, as philanthropy, is staggering to us. And frankly, a little terrifying. This is one of our big fears in the Coast Guard, is that someday we will be in a similar position.
I hope not. I'm quite upset about the way things have been kind of changing in the UK, but I'm not going to edge into politics because that would be, well, it would be impolite to discuss such things over tea and cake or water.
And you would have me at a disadvantage, ma'am, as I am unfamiliar with the political doings on your side of the pond.
Have you ever served with British naval officers?
Not British Navy, but I did serve with the King's Own Border and some gentlemen from Hereford when I was in Iraq.
People tend to talk about the differences between different groups of people, and I think that we need to talk more about the things that we have in common. I was wondering if there were any similarities between you that leapt out as you were working with them.
I mean, certainly. I mean, British persons are very similar to Americans in so many ways, and especially, and this is the thing about being in war, is that it really is the great leveler. Since you're sort of going on firing on all pistons all the time, you're reduced to the common things that you sort of share to work together, the job that you're doing, you know, food, you know, how it tastes, where you're getting it from, you know, letters from home, the difficult personalities in camp that you're working with, those kinds of things. The only real difference, I would say, that I felt between myself and the British was in our attitude towards the mixing of genders. It was a lot more casual, and this was before that we allowed women in combat disciplines when I was over there. And the British were just a lot more relaxed about it. And it's nice to see us coming along in that direction.
Mm. So do you think that there are significant transferable skills that you bring from your military life into your writing career, because obviously you bring a lot of your military knowledge into the subject matter of your novels, but how about the skills?
That's a great question, and I actually wrote an essay about this for Tor.com, and it is that the one thing that the military taught me, which has been super, super useful in writing, is that nobody cares about you. And that's a harsh thing to say. We in the Coast Guard say the sea doesn't care about you. And it's a very important thing to remember. Writing is an incredibly anxiety-provoking occupation. You're basically taking something that's extremely important to you and often feels like you itself, and putting it on a page and sending it out to be judged with such incredible hopes and against such very long odds, ma'am.
Mm.
So when you do that, there's a tendency to see writing groups as group therapy, to spend a lot of time tearing your hair and reading into rejection letters and trying to, sort of feeling that the world's against you. It's just there's a lot of temptation to be self-indulgent. And I certainly sympathize with that. In fact, I engage in that kind of behavior myself. I think we all do. But the fact is, it doesn't help you to meet your goals. Writing is binary. It knows only zero and one. You either put the words on the page or you don't. You either get better at what you're doing or you don't. And all of the rest is noise. The military infrastructure is the same way. Anything you say when you fail to perform a task to standard, no one cares and no one will listen. The rules say X and the consequences are Y, or the rewards are Y, conversely. And you either perform to those rules in a binary fashion or you do not. There are very few segments in society that are so hard-edged. And that skill of being able to face failure without excuses is enormously helpful and transferable into writing. And the three-word phrase we say in the military, which I constantly say to other writers and to myself, is lock it up.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of that attitude I recognize in my father, actually. We have a long history serving in the military. And I think my generation is the first generation that we haven't had one of the children in the Navy for something like four generations or something crazy. And yeah, that kind of very hard but also very positively focused attitude of what can I do, what is the work that can be done here, I think is another aspect of that kind of attitude from his life in the Navy. Do you think that that's the same for you as well?
Absolutely. And the one thing I want to reiterate is, you know, I don't want people to think for a moment that when I say that I don't sympathize with how incredibly hard it is. Every writer I know, every successful writer I know, has been honest on a blog about depression and anxiety and the enormous impact it's had on their lives. Off the top of my head, I can think of Scott Lynch, I can think of Saladin Ahmed, I can think of Ari Marmel. Myself have written those kinds of posts. So I certainly sympathize with it. The reason that I use the term lock it up is because in my experience, that's what helps you get to where you want to go. And that's really my goal, as you say, positively focused. The hardness isn't for hardness' sake or for the satisfaction one gets in causing another person discomfort, quite the opposite. It is, in my estimation, the best way to move a person to the place they want to be.
Mm. Now, going back to the Coast Guards, they have lots of roles. Which one do you feel is the most important role that you have in your job?
Oh, ma'am, that is a near impossible question. I can only tell you I've held two roles. It's actually very funny. The most famous Coast Guard movie in modern memory is The Guardian, which starred Kevin Costner. And I'm often asked if that is the life of a Coast Guard. And the truth is that is the aviation rescue swimmer community, which is so different from what I do that they might as well be another branch. I first served in intelligence. And now I command on the reserve side, a small gunboat squadron in Staten Island. What we do is law enforcement and search and rescue. I personally think that search and rescue is probably the most satisfying thing a Coast Guard can do. You're directly reaching out, grasping hands, and saving lives. And law enforcement, of course, is very important and very exciting. But one of the things I love about the Coast Guard above other military services in the United States is our range of mission. We do pollution cleanup and inspection. We do facility and container inspections. We do aviation. We do drug and illegal migrant interdictions. We do fisheries policing and wildlife rescue and care. We do oil spill response. I don't know any other branch of the military that does it. And one of the other great things about the Coast Guard Reserve is that in the reserve portions of the other four branches of the United States military, they train to fight wars. That's all they do. And if they're not, if we're not in a war, then they're just training on the weekends. Mm-hmm. Well, the Coast Guard, we do our job on the weekends. We are actually doing our search and rescue and law enforcement missions. We are the relief force so that the active duty can go home on the weekend and we can help them maintain that 24-hour posture. It's an enormously, enormously satisfying job.
It sounds it. Aside from yourself, who do you think is the scariest writer to face in a one-on-one death match?
You know, this is so funny. I wrote a blog post on use of force. I keep in good physical conditioning and do take some pride in my skill at arms. And as a result, I'm sometimes, you better buy Mike's books or he'll beat you up. I never respond to those jokes because I believe that I've been invested, American taxpayer dollars have been spent to train me to fight. And if I and with the understanding that I will only apply that training in defense of the American people, and if I turn that training on someone else in a brawl per se, then I am effectively, in my estimation, engaging in treason. And I would gladly suffer a black eye or a fat lip if someone were to punch me in a pub. Then I can walk away with that, rather than sully my honor by engaging in violence outside the normal rules of engagement. So I will decline to answer that question. However, I will say in a one-on-one debate that is contentious, I most fear among the British people Mr. China Mieville, who is an enormous influence on me and one of my favorite writers ever, who I have never met. And I have written about him extensively. I tweet about him. I blog about him. He's one of the most fascinating and inspiring people I know. And he is quite my polar opposite, as he is a self-avowed Trotskyite and proletariat revolutionary. And I am a state maritime officer and police officer. So when the proletariat rise up to throw down the regime in the Miévillean revolution, I'll be on the other side of the riot shield putting them down. And at the same time, there are few people in the world I admire more. And so I greatly fear, but also greatly look forward to the day when I finally meet them.
So when I am about to take tea with somebody, I like to go onto the Twitters and ask if there's any question that a good soul would like to ask you. And there was one that leaped out at me that was asked by a very lovely lady called Minika. And she asked, when are you going to write that Regency romance? Now, Mike, is there something you're not telling us?
Well, this is an old story that she knows. And that is, years ago, I went to the Romance Writers of America convention when it was held in Times Square. And I came up the escalator, and I saw what was quite possibly 1,000 heads in the gallery, and not one of them, from my brief survey, was that of a man. And so when I had lunch later on with my associate who had been attending the convention, and mind you, a very Spartan lunch which contained no sugary confections and certainly no coffee or tea, I asked her, why are there no men here? And she said, well, men don't write romance. And I said, what do you mean we don't write romance? That's absurd. Men fall in love. Men seek to wed. Men certainly make love in the context of a lawfully wedded home and under the auspices of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. I said, what do you mean? Why wouldn't we write these books? And she said, well, I suppose some do, but only under female pseudonyms, because female readers won't buy romance novels written by men. And I said, that's preposterous. Publishers used to say that women couldn't write science fiction and fantasy. That's why Robin Hobb originally wrote under that gender-ambiguous name, or C.J. Shara, or Andre Norton. And I said, it was wrong then, and this is wrong now. And then I made a solemn vow. I, Michael Cole, am going to write romances under my own name. And my friend Lauren Gilman said, well, that's all very well, if you would like to do it. However, you have a lot of learning to do. You can't just waltz into a genre and write it. You have to read. And I thought that was very good advice. And so I spent quite some time reading a great deal of romances. which really benefited my other writing because they made me much more adroit at character writing, because that's really what romances are, and they are fabulous to read. And I have not written the Regency romance, but completely subconsciously, all of that influence of reading romances worked its way into my creative process, and I didn't realize it until I was finished. But my third novel, Breach Zone, which is coming out January 28th, wound up a love story. And my fourth novel, Gemini Cell, which is already done, I'm just going into the sixth draft on it, is very much a love story and a family love story between two married people. So I will say to the question, no, not a Regency one yet, but I've already written two romances, and I expect a great deal more romantic influence in many books to come.
That's splendid. Could you recommend any romances? Because it's a genre I haven't dipped into very much at all. I've read a couple for audiobook work, but I've never actually kind of read any for my own pleasure. It's a genre I haven't experienced much of. Could you direct me?
Well, if you want to read single title, what they call single title romances, that are less erotic and more story driven.
Mm-hmm, that's the kind of thing I'd like.
You cannot do better than Diana Gabaldon's Outlander, which is everything you love about George R. R. Martin's sprawling epic. It's also an historical piece and such a powerful love story. I can't recommend it enough. It's fabulous, and it's big and thick like Martin's Song of Ice and Fire novels, so you'll have many, many pages of delightful reading. Erotic romance is an enormously popular category, one that does not suit me, but just in the interest of making sure it's covered, the author that seems to be most enthusiastically recommended to me was Laura Lee. And I read one book by her called Naughty Nights, naughty deliberately misspelled, N-A-U-T-I. Personally, I found it too graphic to the taste of a gentleman. However, I would not presume to judge other people's reading habits.
Wonderful. And there's romance in Breach Zone as well. That's good to know. So tell me a little bit more about the Shadow Ops books, because Breach Zone is the third in the series, isn't it?
Yes, and closing out the trilogy. I think my publisher very much likes to take one protagonist and write many, many, many books about them. And they have enjoyed great success with Patty Briggs and Jim Butcher. However, I don't work that way. Those aren't the kind of books I like to read. So all three of my Shadow Ops novels have different protagonists, and Breach Zone concludes the trilogy. It finishes the storyline. The fourth book, Gemini Cell, will be in the same universe, but it's not the same storyline. The Shadow Ops series is the best summary I can come up with. Was given as a jacket quote from my friend, who's a fantastic fantasy writer who everyone should read, Peter V. Brett, and he called it Black Hawk Down meets the X-Men.
Wonderful.
And I think it's fantastic. I always say Harry Potter joins the army. The basic premise is that magic has returned into the world, and the American government clamps down on it as a way to protect what it believes is protecting the public. But, of course, engendering the same kind of choices we face today in the age of terrorism, which is the trade-off between civil liberties and security, you have, sorcerers in the military, and I think it's the best thing. If Harry Potter, instead of going off to Hogwarts, had joined the Navy SEALs, this is the story you would get.
That's wonderful. So I have one last question, which is somewhat of an experiment. I took tea with a very wonderful person a couple of weeks ago called Melinda Snodgrass. And you might have noticed, just over there behind the sofa, there are a couple of chickens. They've been quite well behaved today.
I was meaning to ask you about that.
Yes, it is. Well, Latimer did say that he wondered if I should have them elsewhere whilst I take tea, but they did something so wonderful when I had tea with Melinda that I wanted to try an experiment, and it involves asking you the question that if you had to choose a theme tune for yourself, be it from a musical or from television or film or any kind of music, what would it be?
Oh, that's a very easy choice, ma'am. And I've long dreamed of, in a parade, having this played as my unit march past the review stand. Sadly, I don't think it'll happen in my lifetime, but it would be the Imperial March from Star Wars.
Oh, I love that piece of music. It's just so wonderful.
It is.
My best friend has that play on her mobile phone when her parents call.
Outstanding. That was delightful.
Oh, yes, and here they go. Yes, the chickens are singing it. How wonderful. They are magical chickens.
Yes, they certainly are. Sam, I think I can say with complete confidence, I'm something of a stranger to customs in your land, but in the United States of America, in our free republic, we don't have chickens who sing.
Well, I can't say that they're common in the British Isles either. I received them as a gift from an admirer. I have had no idea who would send somebody singing chickens, but I'm delighted that they have.
Doubtless they will improve bilateral relations between our two great nations.
Well, I do hope so, and I like to play my small part in that by inviting you to tea and giving you water instead,
yes,
if you wish.
Thank you very much for that.
Well, the Banbury cake is almost gone. I have to make sure that I leave a portion for you, of course, and the teapot is almost empty. Of course, I've been drinking so much tea because you haven't, so I think it's probably time for you to go, because I believe you're on duty soon.
Yes, ma'am. I hope you'll forgive me, and I must make my excuses.
Oh, no, not at all. Thank you so much for taking the time to come and visit. It's been an absolute delight to speak to you again, and I believe you'll be at Worldcon in London.
Yes, I will, and I'm hoping to, if I can find the time, to do something of a small, at least London tour, or maybe even further around in Britain when Control Point came out, I went to the Waterstones at Milton Keynes. I'd very much like to at least visit there again.
Oh, I know. Oh, if you have time, and you may not, I would love to recommend to you visiting the Victory, HMS Victory, which is moored in Portsmouth, which was Nelson's famous ship.
And sure, of course.
It's just so beautiful there, and just such an amazing experience to walk around it in terms of maritime history. It's just glorious. So if you do get a chance, I heartily recommend that.
Yes, ma'am. And I always go to Greenwich and stand on the Prime Meridian. Every mariner has to do that when they're in striking distance of Greenwich.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, it's been a delight, and I hope that your next shift is just the right kind of exciting.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you very much. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you.
Lovely. Do take care.
You too, ma'am.
Bye.
Bye.
This way, sir.
But that's the way to the ballroom.
The other exit is currently blocked. I'm sure a ballroom will prove no great challenge for a gentleman of Lieutenant Cole's calibre.
Most of them are too busy drinking and dancing to notice. Just put this cloak on, Mike. You'll be fine.
May I offer my congratulations, ma'am?
What for?
Lieutenant Cole mentioned that author, and you didn't say anything that might embarrass yourself.
You're right! Well, I started taking those tablets you gave me, and I've been able to talk about China Mieva without hyperventilating for a couple of weeks now.
I'm delighted to be of help, ma'am. I've been free of such attacks for over 50 years now, and I've never looked back.
You really don't look your age, Latimer. I'm going to make sure Mike is all right. There he goes. What a lovely man. I must say, he cuts a fine figure crossing the ballroom.
It seems the ladies present agree with you, ma'am.
He doesn't seem to have noticed them yet.
Oh, dear. The Countess of Devonshire has noticed him.
She's very beautiful.
And I'm afraid she knows it, ma'am. There isn't a man in the county who has been able to resist her charms.
She's blocking the exit. She's determined to dance with him.
I must say, that's a very inventive use of a bustle.
What if she traps him here? What if her beauty makes him forget his duty?
It is well known that coast guards are virtuous to the point of single-mindedness. They are Neptune's sons, born on the crest of waves, suckled by mermaids, and rocked in the cradle of the deep. Their eyes are stars and their teeth spars. Their hair is hemp and seaweed.
Latimer?
As such, resisting bustles and decolletage is a small matter. Lieutenant Cole is no savage Helene who needs to lash himself to a mast and stuff his ears with tallow. He could look the siren in the eye, for what does she have that the ocean lacks? The waves are rolling curves that no woman can match. The water is bluer than the loveliest eyes. The salt tang sweeter than any perfume.
Latimer?
My apologies. I have the greatest respect for seafaring men.
He is making his excuses, I think. She's not accepting them. Oh, dear. For him to refuse the Countess would be a dreadful faux pas.
I think he's realised that, ma'am.
He's taking her hand. I had no idea he could dance.
Of course, ma'am. All sailors are bred to the hornpipe, and it is a jaunty...
Oh, Latimer.
Sorry, ma'am.
Oh, those gentlemen over there look very unhappy. And strangely similar to each other.
That's the Count, ma'am, and his 17 brothers.
Surely they wouldn't be so rude as to draw swords at a ball.
I wouldn't worry, ma'am. He's a lieutenant of Coast Guards. They have fought on countless shores from Asia to Europe to Old Araby. They are bred to the sword.
Oh no, it's going to be a slaughter. And he's got so many more books to write.
No, ma'am. He will not quail. Lesser men might call it slaughter. I call it even odds.
He's disarmed the Count. And Mike has decided to spare his life. What a good sport. The others daren't fight him now. Just as well. It would have been a dreadful mess to clear up.
I'm sure my great-great-grandfather has had to deal with worse.
I didn't mean the blood. I meant the space-time continuum.
So did I, ma'am.
Well, as Lieutenant Cole extricates himself from the continued attentions of the Countess, I'd like to thank you for joining us here today. Lovelies, there's all sorts of talk online about award nomination season, and it's occurred to me that we don't have an award on Tea and Jeopardy. I thought it might be fun to have one, perhaps on the anniversary of when we first took tea together. But what kind of award should we have? Best dressed guest? Most daring escape? What would you like to reward the guests for? If you have an award idea, do be dears, and let me know on the Twitters. I'm MApocalyptic over there, or in the comments for this episode on TeaAndJeopardy.com. Well, until next time, my sugar plums. Now, Latimer, I was wondering if you could get me some more of those tablets. A friend on Twitter sent me a gif of Tom Hiddleston being a vampire in his latest film, and I haven't quite recovered.
Very good, ma'am.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman. Go to www.teaandjeopardy.com to find out more and join in.